is at the death. People cool, people happy, they went quiet.
Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 127. Yes, welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast. In this episode, we sit down with my friend and one of my favorite journalists, author Will Storr, whose new book just hit the shelves here in the United States. It's called Selfie, How We Became So Self-Obsessed and What It Is Doing to Us. The book explores what he calls the age of perfectionism, our modern struggle with our many modern pressures to meet newly emerging ideals and standards that tell us if we're falling short of the person we ought to be. And, as he says in the book, perfectionism is the idea that kills. And you'll hear what he means by that in the interview. In the book, Will embarks on two investigative journeys. The first is an examination of the self as a psychological mechanism, and he digs deep into what science has to say about where our concept of the self originated and how it operates so that he can understand how perfectionism causes that mechanism to malfunction. The second is how the cultural concept of self originated and then evolved over millennia. The very concept of a self has changed many times, as have the pressures that concept has endured. And depending on where you live today, that lineage of your culture's ideas of the self strongly differs from that of people who live elsewhere, surrounded by different cultural norms and expectations that change what it means to be a fully realized and unique individual. As he writes, it is the self that wants to become perfect, and it's our culture that tells us what perfect actually is. It's a great book. I hope you check it out. And for this episode, Will and I just have a conversation about it. And there's some great, great prescriptive advice near the end involving a lizard and an iceberg. So that's what you're about to hear. And please forgive some of the quality of the audio. I recorded this interview while on the road, but what Will has learned is so compelling, and I love the conversation. I don't think you will mind. All right. Let's pick his brain. Answer for this. And I know that we're joining a conversation 2,000 years on, but, you know, what is a self?
What is a self? Well, I mean, it's a very good question. So, I mean, the kind of the answer that I've got is that it's kind of the mechanism through which we experience ourselves and the world. That's my kind of in a nutshell answer to what is a self. It's that kind of psychological, neurological mechanism through which we kind of experience everything.
And so why would this be selected for by, why would natural selection, what pressures would bring this on? Like, why is this useful to our organism?
Well, I mean, you're asking why do we have consciousness? And I don't think there's an, I don't think that anyone has got a very sensible answer to that question. That's one of the sort of big mysteries of, you know,
really hoping you'd have an answer.
but you know, I think to view the self is ultimately, I think what kind of brain and mind and self wants to do is to control the world, and I think, you know, having a self is an essential kind of component of that. One of the ways that we can, you know, we experience self is through that voice in our heads, that internal monologue that's constantly sort of narrating our every move.
This is important. The left brain interpreter, which we've talked about at least a dozen times on the show, but to see it come back, because this just as you experienced the day that I learned this was a thing, it changed everything about how I thought about myself and others. It's a real revelatory moment. And for people who've never heard of this, just take us through it.
So again, I agree. It's changed everything, and it's such an important idea that I've resigned myself to having to explain it in every single book I ever write, because I don't think you can really talk in much in depth about the big issues in psychology without understanding this, because it's extraordinary. So it's this voice that we have in our heads that's explaining our behavior and telling us who we are and what we're doing and why we think what we think and why we feel what we feel has no access to the parts of the brain that controls and generates why we do what we do or why we think what we think. So it's basically making stuff up. It's, you know, we really have no access. We have no idea why we do what we do, why we think what we think, why we feel what we feel. We have got no, we don't know for sure. And sometimes that voice will be right, but equally it might be wrong. And I think the easiest way of understanding it is just imagine you're on a date with some hot person, and it's a first date, and you go to a gallery, you're trying to impress them, you're in a gallery, and you go and there's a big Rothko, and everyone loves Rothko, and you say to your date, "Oh, I love Rothko," and your date goes, "Oh well, tell me, why do you like Rothko? What do you like about Rothko?" And you immediately start making up a load of old nonsense, right? You just start going and bullshitting to them, and that's confabulation. And the kind of disturbing thing is that we find is that we're actually doing that all the time
for everything.
Why do you want to be a writer? Why do you why did you just snap at your wife? Why did you for every question you can possibly imagine, it's all a confabulation. And as I say, sometimes it's perhaps even often it's a real explanation, but equally it might not be. And as I say, it's completely changed the way I experience myself and my life, because you can't imagine having a self without having that voice. For one, and also now I just don't, whereas before I would have woken up, "God, I'm feeling really depressed. Why am I feeling depressed? Oh, it's because of, I've got to do this today, and oh, it's because of this argument." I just don't even bother thinking about it anymore. I just accept that I'm feeling down that day, yeah, and move on, because I know it's just, there's just no point.
Yeah.
And it's also changed the way that I think about therapy, because to me it's the whole therapeutic process feels like you're just swapping one confabulation for another confabulation. Mm-hmm. And that could be a really good thing. It's actually be a really, really positive thing.
Yeah, reframing is great if it's done properly. Yeah.
No, that's what you're doing. You get a bit suspicious.
That's true. You need to trust that. You need to find a good reframer.
Yeah. You're really convincing one.
Someone who's a better reframer than you. That's the that's the therapist you need in your life. Yeah, it's so much, and it bears out in study after study after study after study study, and people do it so readily, and they have, if they're always thinking those studies, if they weren't debriefed, they'd have no idea that, the study where they switch out the pictures and you don't realize they switch out the pictures, and you just keep explaining why you like the picture that you weren't talking about beforehand, or they have you test the same stockings and you say this one's better than the other because of these 11 reasons, but it's the same stocking.
The stocking one's great. So there's a known quirk in psychology that when you give people a bunch of things to choose from, they tend to choose the last thing they've seen.
Yeah.
So what they do is they give women, so they have a look at these stockings and tell me what your favorite one is. And then they tend to choose the last one. And actually all the stockings are identical. So then they go, "So what did you like those stockings best?" And they go, "Oh," and they give all these reasons. And then they say to them, did it ever occur to you that you might have chosen those stockings just because they were the last ones you see? And I think, I can't remember, I'm paraphrasing, but in the paper actually says that more often than not, the participants looked at the experiment as if we were mad.
Yeah.
They were just like, yeah, what are you talking about? That's insane. But that's the actual reason why they chose the stockings. Yeah. So it's a kind of enormously kind of convincing idea, and I guess that it's a clue, really, I think, to why do we have a self, why do we have consciousness, because it's all part of that idea of the confabulation is a story. It's a story that we tell about the world, and of course the hero of the story that we tell about the world, if we're not depressed, if we're mentally healthy, is that we are this kind of hero, we are this moral actor, striving against great odds in order to make a better life for ourselves, and having that story is massively beneficial to us, obviously. I mean individuals having that story is what's built the world. It's what has enabled humans to conquer the planet and build all the cities and civilizations. It is millions and millions and millions and millions of individuals confabulating merrily away, completely convinced that they're the heroes, that the center of the universe, and that the thing that they're doing is all important and is going to make their life somehow better. And of course, you know, often at times it does make their life somehow better. So you see that one of the amazing qualities of having this particular human self.
What you made me think here is, you know, I agree with you completely, and obviously so. And, you know, if you think about like, why does if you have like a company that has a mission statement and, you know, they have like a creed, or even a nation that has like some high ideal that everyone sort of subscribes to, and you want to get reductionist about it, you can get that. You can break this all the way down to atoms and molecules if you want to. And you can say, well, really, the company's doing this because it wants to have survival tokens to buy bananas, you know, if you want to get all the way down with it. So in a way, the story that the company tells about itself is this grand confabulation that everyone agrees to. And I can almost see that as a metaphor for, you know, this sort of parliament of competing agencies that, and this, the unifying thing being this story, this confabulation, just so they can all get on with it and, you know,
go. Yeah.
And so there's, but there is, as you say in the book, there is a definite, there's another edge to this sword, which is that, when we tell, there's certain stories we will start telling about ourselves that can lead to absolute ruin when it comes to the self. In fact, you start the book out right there talking about suicide. I was very surprised that we were starting there. So instead of giving it all away, why did you start with suicide, and what did you learn about like, how our notion of ourselves can lead to suicide? Because, you know, this is the ultimate rebuke to natural selection and our whole evolutionary past, to snuff ourselves out, to end our chances of survival and continue procreation. So it's incredibly fascinating that you would start there. So, yeah, tell us more about that.
Yeah. So I started with suicide, for exactly that reason, because it's the ultimate rebuke. It doesn't make any sense. You know, we've just been saying having a human self is this thing where we are doers, we are strugglers, we are fighters. We get up, we can, you know, with all those amazingly kind of powerful biases and prejudices that we have, convinced ourselves that we're in the best tribe, that we are heroes, we're moral actors, and that the story of our lives is kind of full of hope and promise, and that's what humans do. And so, you know, we are above all else, we want to survive. So what on earth could it be that could cause a human self to actually want to make it destroy itself? I mean, that seemed to me like a really, really interesting question, because it didn't make any sense. And it felt very timely as well, because, you know, there's lots of sort of data out there in the world that suicide is on the increase. And since the 1980s, since the launch of these sort of blockbuster antidepressants, which actually are especially effective at treating serious depression, which is the most likely form of depression to lead to suicide. Actually, as bad as the suicide figures are, they would be hugely worse. You can extrapolate if we didn't have around 10% of the population of the UK and the US on antidepressants at any one time. So it felt to me like a very timely question, and I thought that, you know, the answer is going to tell us something sort of quite interesting about the self. And so, having suffered from kind of suicidal ideation myself before, as a journalist, as I'm sure you know, when you've had a thing that's important to you personally, you tend to write lots about it. And I'd written quite a few different separate stories about suicide, and I'd met lots of people who had survived suicide, or who were partners, parents of people who had taken their own lives. And there was this thing that kept cropping up, and it's this idea that this person had unusually high expectations for themselves, and the problem had been that those expectations had not been met again and again and again and again, and they felt stuck. And so, you know, I looked into this, and there's this interesting model by Professor Roy Baumeister, very brilliant, you know, emeritus professor of psychology, and he sort of found this. He found something similar, that that it's people who have these kind of particularly high expectations for themselves and kind of fail to meet them. And then that led me to ask the question, well, you know, why might this be happening so much at the moment? And you kind of expand it out from suicide to other kind of self-attacking behaviors, whether it be eating disorder, self-harm, or any of these other sort of behaviors in which kind of selves start attacking themselves. And what they all have in common, one of the traits that predicts them is perfectionism. So when people are kind of perfectionistic, it makes you more vulnerable, more likely to kind of suffer from these problems. And so one of the definitions of perfectionism is when you're doing perfectionistic thinking, you are more highly sensitive to signals of failure in your environment. So if you're very or relatively easily be triggered into feeling like a failure, then that's going to cause you problems. It's going to lead to some of this sort of very negative perfectionistic thinking. And so that made me think, well, that's interesting, because we have a cultural environment at the moment where it seems to me it's very easy to push people into, can trigger people into feeling like they're failures. I mean, we have a kind of economy that's really tough, especially on young people. It's hard to get on the housing ladder. It's hard to make a living. Much harder than it was, say, in the kind of 50s and 60s to kind of get along and get ahead in our culture. We've got this social media thing happening, which is just come out of nowhere in the last 10 years, in which people are being made to feel like failures all the time. That can come in the guise of, you know, the pictures on Instagram where everyone looks so kind of perfect. And then we, you know, one of the fundamental ways the brain understands how it's doing in the social world is it compares itself to the people around it. You know, we've evolved to live in tribes of around 150 people, as you know, and so that's not that many people to compare yourself to, and they'd all been roughly like us. But now we're on Instagram, and now we're flicking past, you know, Kim Kardashian and Jennifer Lawrence, and then there's us. And so even if we know logically that Kim Kardashian and Jennifer Lawrence or whoever it is and our friends are only putting their most perfectly kind of sculpted moments from their lives onto Instagram, unconsciously it's still a hit. It's still making us feel as if we're failures. And then there's this incredible political pressure at the moment. There's, you know, we're living in very febrile, tribalistic times, and there's a huge pressure out there to have the perfect political views. And there's an increased sense of risk and danger if you stray outside those perfect political views. The ramifications can be disastrous.
Yeah, we're the most judged ever. It feels like there are eyes upon us everywhere, and that if the slightest misstep and we will be ostracized from our tribe. That is primal, and that is visceral, and that is, we're keen, and we are, we're on edge in that way. It's almost, because you mentioned in the book that joining social media and becoming very active in it, almost always leads to unhappiness. It increases your unhappiness, but disconnecting from social media doesn't sort of increase happiness. So it's, you're just bringing something into your life that is causing stress. And that may be temporary, that may be of our time, and we may figure it out and we may become better at it. But, it certainly is true, in this moment. And you bring it up, you dive really deep into that and how, I know that in previous eras, we talked about how much women were being judged and being told you have to be this perfect person. Mm. And you also bring up how men have an ideal that they're trying to subscribe to, and they both feel like they're falling short.
Yeah, so this is an extraordinary thing that's just happened in the last few years. I mean, I've noticed it. I mean, I'm sure it's the same in the US, but certainly in the UK, where for as long as you can think, women have had this awful pressure to have these kind of perfect bodies, right? You've got to look 18 for your whole life, you know, if you're a woman, and it's terrible. It's this awful pressure that women feel. And when I was young, men didn't really have that pressure. I mean, you know, of course, people were mean to people who are overweight, and but it was the grunge era. It was Generation X. Mm-hmm. We were down at music venues drinking cider, smoking roll ups, and watching bands. You know, that was what we were doing.
Wearing flannels.
These days, yeah, exactly. These days, the kids are they're in the gym, they're eating salads, they're eating protein bars. I mean, and so one of these statistics that came out in between the hardback and the over here in the UK, the paperback, is that within just 2 years in the UK, hospital referrals for eating disorders in men, young men, had gone up by 43%. And it's unbelievable. And now if you watch the reality TV shows, I mean, I'm a bit of a reality TV show junkie. I love them, as I think most people who are interested in psychology probably do have a secret guilty pleasure in watching reality TV shows. The major difference is that young men in reality TV shows now always have their tops off and have these unbelievably beautiful torsos. Like, they are gorgeous. When I was their age, I didn't know a single person who had those bodies. Mm-hmm. And those bodies are hard to get and they're hard to maintain. And that's now seen as the norm for young people. Young people have to be stacked. They have to have pecs and biceps and, you know, pelvic V lines. And it's just an extraordinary new pressure. And that's the tragedy of it all, is that rather than learning, Jesus, we've been bullying women for generations with this, let's stop doing this, it's just spreading now to young men. Mm. So this is just one of the ways, I think, that we are, you know, everybody has to be a celebrity. They have to look like a celebrity these days and have to live a kind of celebrity lifestyle these days. Is that the idea? One of the psychologists I spoke to for the book said, I'm paraphrasing her, said, you know, back in the day, back in the 40s, this idea that there were the stars, the famous people, we called them the stars. The idea was they were up there in the heavens. They weren't like us. And now, you know, post-reality TV, post-social media, we're not, you know, keeping up with, we know we're keeping up with the Kardashians these days. We're all trying to be the Kardashians, and that's the expectation. And it's just it's an incredible pressure, and it is just one more. That's just one of the pressures.
I have this right here. These are your words. I had to copy paste this. I was like, oh my god, because in the West, you know, our current ideal self is extroverted, slim, beautiful, individualistic, optimistic, hardworking, socially aware, high self-esteem, global citizen with entrepreneurial guile and a selfie camera. That enjoys thinking it's unique, it's trying to make the world a better place, and values personal authenticity or being real. You have to be true to yourself, follow your dreams. If you dream big enough, anything is possible. And you have to also be younger than 30. but you follow that up with saying, there is no such human being. So how did this happen? How did that become the thing that we all think we have to be?
Well, I mean, so partly it's, you know, it's a, you know, just one small part of it is this kind of gender thing. So one of the studies I write about was they asked a bunch of men and a bunch of women, what does it take to be a man? And they found that in order to be a man, you have to be a fighter, a winner, a provider, a protector, and you have to maintain mastery and control at all times. But you also have to show kind of vulnerability. You're still kind of not like, yeah. So it's really hard. And you've got that whole thing with women. So now women have to, you know, have it all. So they have to be a great mom and have a great family, but they also have to be brilliant in business and, you know, go girl and lean in and all that stuff. So there's just this huge global pressure on everyone to be perfect. And the complicated thing about that is that it's brilliant that women are now empowered and encouraged to be every bit as successful in the financial world as men. And it's brilliant that men are now encouraged to be better fathers and kinder and keep a lid on their anger and all that stuff. You can't argue against any of that stuff, but the underside of that is that it's just another thing that increases, you know, the pressure on individuals. It just raises that bar higher. The bar being, am I a successful person? Am I the person that I want to be and the society wants me to be? It just makes it's just raised that bar. And as to the kind of broader question, how did we end up with this ideal self with that sort of big list that you just read? So I think, if there's one idea, if there's one idea that kind of runs through Selfie, and it's really about the power of culture and the power of our environment to kind of create who we are, and it begins in ancient Greece. I mean, the story of the Western personality, the Western self, begins in ancient Greece, and it's some really extraordinary work by psychologists that have looked at how the environment kind of creates our sense of self. I just thought this was extraordinary. And so what was particular about ancient Greece was it wasn't like a country as if you a nation that you'd imagine one today, like this kind of this area of land demarcated. It's 1,000 individual communities, mm-hmm. called city states, but a good lot of them weren't, they're not cities in the size that we'd think of them today. And they're either on little rocky outcrops or islands, or they're on kind of coastal waters in mountains descending to sea. So you've already got this very individualist landscape, and it creates a sense of freedom, because in other, you know, this is Game of Thrones world 2,500 years ago. It's a world of gods and monsters and tyrannies. And if you upset people in most places, you'd probably be killed, you know, if you upset the powers that be. But in ancient Greece, if you upset the powers that be, you could just hop off to another city state. So you had this kind of sense of freedom. But the other idea is that because of the ecology of the land, because it was rocky, it was all rocky, and you couldn't do much good to any sort of farming or agriculture. You couldn't have big, wheat growing areas. So in order to get along and get ahead, which is what evolutionary psychologists tell us that kind of human is the basic kind of human instinct. You had to be a bit of a hustler. You had to be a small business owner, essentially. You had to make olive oil, tan hides, be a fisherman, so you had to kind of privilege yourself over the group. You had to push yourself forward, and again, because of the ecology, everybody was sort of trading with each other, and in these different communities had different ideas, and the ideas would spread, and people from other parts of the sort of globe would sail in and do trading. So there was all these new ideas flowing about. Kind of from this came this culture of kind of debate, where people would kind of debate each other, and that became a thing where you could gain lots of status. And from this comes this idea that the kind of, I guess, the locus of power in the world is the individual rather than the group, and it's the individual which should, you know, Aristotle said that the individual was on this kind of natural path towards perfection, which is sounds like something you'd hear today. And you know, it's the world where the Olympics happens, you know, this amazing competition of self against self. It's a world where for 50 years democracy happened. I mean, it's just extraordinary in that world that for 50 years you could vote, and you know, the individual, although they were just privileged men, they could vote and have some say in who was kind of running the community. You had the veneration of the physical self, you know, so you had statues of ideal forms of masculine and feminine beauty up in public places. So it's a really kind of amazing kind of idea that the ecology essentially forms this sense of self, which forms this culture. And when I was first reading about this, you automatically think, well, this is just a bit of a just so story. This is, you know, surely everybody would seek glory, everybody seeks fame, everybody wants to win the Olympics. This is just what it's like to be a human being. And I think that just shows you how deep culture stretches within us, because that's actually not the case. And we know it's not the case, because you compare people from the West to people from East Asia. So at the same time that Aristotle was walking around in ancient Greece, Confucius was walking around in East Asia, around China. And China's the opposite of ancient Greece. It's just a landlocked place, no new ideas coming in, easy to conquer, so easy for kind of tyrannies to kind of to impose themselves. And to get along and get ahead in ancient Greece, you had to in East Asia, you was generally big farming communities, so rice or wheat, or they had these massive, huge irrigation projects. So you had to privilege the group over the self, because it was important, that it was vital more than anything that the group worked, because it was the group that made these big projects work. And so when you get people, you know, inherit, like modern inheritors of these cultures in the lab today, you can see the effects still there. So one of the things that they do is they track your, they put your these glasses over your eyes, and they track your saccades, so they track the movement of your eyes as it's scanning the environment. So if you put like an American person in front of a video of a fish tank, right, and in the fish tank there's this big fish at the front. The Westerner, the person with the kind of Greek inheritance, their eyes will mostly look at that big fish at the front, and will only relatively occasionally flip out to look at the context. Whereas the East Asian person will be constantly scanning between the context and the fish at the in the middle. Mm-hmm. And you take them out of the lab and you say, so what did you just see? And the individualist, the American, will go, I saw a big fish. as a big fish. And you ask the East Asian person, who is the kind of groupish Confucian, and they'll go, I saw a fish tank and there was a bunch of fish in it and there was a fish at the front. And then you say, well, tell me about the fish at the front. And the American will go, well, that was the leader. That was obviously the leader fish. I like that fish. And you ask the East Asian, well, I felt sorry for that fish because the fish had obviously been ostracized by the group and I wondered what that fish had done wrong. So it's just extraordinary. You see, you see how differences in the landscape 2,500 years ago create different versions of reality. You know, even to the depth at which our eyes are unconsciously scanning the environment, and from that emerges just a different value system. You know, it's really extraordinary differences. So in Selfie, I track that idea along. So these ideas are well known and well studied. In terms of ancient Greece and ancient China and modern West and modern kind of East Asia, and also there's some famous looks at kind of North and South America where these ideas pan out too. So today it's not the ecology that we are dependent on. That it's not the ecology that defines how we get along and get ahead, because technology is such that we've broken free of ecology. So what is it? Well, today it's the economy. It's the state of the economy that determines who we have to be in order to get along and get ahead. Okay, so think about the economy now in the West. Think about who we were in 1965. So in 1965, we are hippies, essentially. We are collectivist, anti-materialistic, much more Eastern. And it was the era when Eastern ideas began to sort of flood the culture. Meditation and so on. We're anti-materialistic, anti-man, all that stuff. And so look at the economy at the time. And this was a surprise to me, just how collective the economy was in America and the UK, you know, before I was born. So in the US, you had, you know, unionization, you had loads of regulation on banking and business. You had up to 90% tax on the wealthy in America, just extraordinary. So out of this collective economy becomes a collective self, you know, those collective laws came out of the Second World War and came out of the Great Depression. So and out of those collective laws and regulations became corporation man and woman, came, you know, the first generation of the collective American self, and they had children, and those children became the hippies, and that's who we were in 1965. So now fast forward to 1985. Who were we in 1985? Just 20 years later, the Western self has undergone an absolute transformation. We have become yuppies. We are the opposite of the hippies. You know, our values have completely changed. We are wearing red braces in Wall Street, going on about how greed is good. And I know this is a caricature I'm making, but it's just, you know, to make the point of how much we've changed in just 20 years. It's unbelievable. And now think about it. What happened in exactly between those dates, 65 and 85? Our economy transformed. Thatcher and Reagan came along and they brought in this new idea. In the 70s, the economy was in chaos and we had to get to grips with it. So we had to look for an idea. How are we going to get the economy back under our control? And the idea that they settled upon was neoliberalism. So neoliberalism is to get rid of all those collective ideas, get rid of all the collective, you know, release banking and business from all the regulations, reduce the welfare state, attack the unions. What we want to do is turn all of human life into a competitive game of self versus self. So it's, in a way, it's a reversion to ancient Greece. It's this, you create this environment where you've got to be a hustler to survive, because the government ain't going to look after you, the unions ain't going to look after you, and your employers ain't going to look after you either, because all of those regulations are gone. And it's just extraordinary how quickly we start seeing changes in the culture. So there's this really great Gene Twenge study that looked at how we name our children. So in 1982 this began, so just 2 years after, you know, after this neoliberal revolution began, and she found that people started giving their children unusual names. So for as long as you can think of, we've been calling our kids Jennifer, Victoria, George, Albert, you know, all the usual names, and suddenly people start giving their children weirdly spelled names, unusual names, unique names. And, you know, as Gene Twenge says, it's because people wanted their kids to stand out and be a star. So as a whole new value system comes out of this comes out of the economy. This is the era of gym fix and all the, you know, keep fit, and jogging becomes a big thing. And again, that's never left us. We still are, into, you know, obsessed with wellness and physical fitness and and CrossFit, or, you know, on all these ideas. So you see it just happening absolutely in perfect time. The economy changes, we change as a people, and that's because there's a bunch of new rules now. What humans want fundamentally is to get along and get ahead. And when the economy changes, you have to be a different kind of person in order to get along and get ahead. And that sort of big list of qualities, you know, we have to be entrepreneurial, young, fit, thin, globally minded. You know, we live in a kind of globalist economy. These are all the person that doesn't exist, that culture wants us to exist, is the person best suited to thrive in its particular environment.
We're describing like the cyborg that we would create to survive in this environment. It's like we're imagining, this is like a science fiction story where you imagine the perfect predator for the, you know, it doesn't exist, but it, I mean, what you're speaking to here is, and this is something you say in the book, is that who we are is the reflection of the environment in which we need to be. I mean, it's selective pressures. It's all it is. You know, we're fitting ourselves into the ecological niche, is what you're saying. And it just happens that it's not tooth and nail anymore. It's economic. I mean, I'm just repeating what you just said, but it's revelatory, especially in that, since psychology is having to go through its epiphany about weirds, because even in the exploration of the psyche and man itself, or human, the exploration of the actual, you know, essence of humanity, did not itself realize that people were different than the people in the culture in which they had found themselves making this exploration. So, and you know, as you point out in the book, in Eastern Asian cultures, they were almost never had an autobiography. Self-esteem doesn't even exist. They had to borrow the word from our language. They value their leaders when they're shy. It's okay to punish someone if it betters the group, even if that person didn't do anything wrong. And even in the storytelling, and I know that you teach storytelling, and it's a very important thing in your life, their version of the hero's tale ends with all the characters being right and wrong at the same time. And so it's up to you, dear reader, to figure out what the point of the story was, and who was the hero, and what do we gain from it. It seems like, you know, we're talking about a completely different kind of person and a kind of brain, because we are. And you illustrate that so well in the book, that that I think there is prescriptive bias in that for me, in that, okay, just realize that this perfect self is the self that would survive in this environment. No problem. Never, ever, ever have to worry about anything. It doesn't exist. It's some angelic, you know, entity. But the most important thing is when the times change, when this environment that we find ourselves within changes, that idea of perfection is going to change too. So you're really chasing the dragon here.
Yeah, so I think that was one of the ideas that came out of the book, which I thought was really interesting, was this idea of story being tribal propaganda. So psychologists are increasingly talking about the importance of gossip to human beings. You know,
it's like 60% of our day-to-day conversation is just gossip.
Yeah, some studies put it at 90%.
Oh,
Mark Gazzaniga put it at 90%, 80-90% in his book. So I don't know. Yeah. But it's a lot. And some psychologists are even talking about this idea that the reason human language evolved in the first place is to swap gossip. You know, this idea before, that it was one of the ideas was it was about coordinating kind of hunting. But of course, wolves hunt as a pack perfectly well without having sophisticated language. You know, as I said earlier, we are a hypersocial species. Our realm, our Umwelt, is the human realm. So it kind of makes sense. And gossip is where reputation lives. So, you know, so people's reputation in that tribe would have been of ultimate crucial importance to your reputation. Because if you developed a bad reputation, you risk being, you know, violently attacked or ostracized, which would have been a death sentence. So we still today are we still today are completely preoccupied by our own personal reputations. It's still incredibly important to us. But so it's in gossip that the tribe's ideal self would have come into being. You know, so it's in the stories we swap, and oh, this person did this really amazing thing. Out of that emerges this kind of rough outline of a perfect self, and that has never changed. That storytelling still does that. Storytelling, the stories that we tell as a culture, the heroes that emerge out of those stories, tend to be that this is the person who is. This is the person that our tribe wants you to be. You know, mm-hmm. our tribe wants you to be
the absolute best suited kind of hero. To our environment. Yeah,
our environment. Yeah. So stories is like this kind of tribal propaganda. It's the heroes that emerge out of a culture. Stories are these kind of ciphers. They are, as you say, the cutout person who is best equipped to kind of survive and thrive in that particular environment. So it's a complete fabrication. That person doesn't actually exist. It's just who your culture wants you to be.
Yeah.
It's kind of almost doing you a favor. It's kind of saying, look, try and be this person because you're going to do well. This is the person that gets celebrated by our tribe. Yeah. This is the person that gets applauded. This is the person that gets their picture put up in the marketplace or in adverts. This is what they're like.
And we can see it's a moving target now that our history is much more recorded and easy to access. And you can so see the ideal man or ideal woman or just ideal person from just 20 years ago now doesn't seem to fit. You can almost see someone who strove their whole life to be that person and now they are in as best they can be, and then they enter into the next era and they're like, yeah, we've changed what it is now. Sorry about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we're going through a period of radical change at the moment, and you're right. I mean, values are changing so rapidly at the moment that people who are in middle age now or, are looking back at their early life and going, well, the person that I was told I should be back then is now a villain.
You're right.
So, it's a time of rapid change. And I think it's interesting as well. I mean, it's too soon to draw any conclusions about the causes of all this. But what's interesting to me is that, of course, social media has caused a lot of these issues, as I know you've explored in one of your previous podcasts. But also in 2008, there was a massive economic crisis, there's a global financial crisis. And all of this increase in tribalism and increase in discord and increase in kind of fury at the people who are perceived to have higher status in the culture. It begins with the Occupy movement that came out after that, and again, you see this looking back in history. You see increases in tribalism and people flocking towards the extremes of left and right after economic shocks, and so I wonder if the global financial crisis had a part to play in this increase in tribal thinking that we're experiencing at the moment.
And now we take a break from our show for a word from our sponsor. I'm always trying to learn as much as I can. I'm sure it's the same for you. It's why you're listening to this podcast. And the great Courses Plus is the streaming service created for people just like us. And if you haven't signed up yet, well, you need to, because this is one of my favorite ways to spend time learning from these leading professors and experts about anything that interests me: psychology, politics, math, science, even how to take better photos. There's unlimited access to more than 10,000 fascinating lectures. Watch or listen along anytime, anywhere with the Great Courses Plus app. The Great Courses Plus has a new course that I highly recommend: Why You Are Who You Are, Investigations into Human Personality. Now, this course is actually 24 lectures. It has Why We Are What We Are, What Is Personality, Key Traits, Extroversion and Neuroticism, Are You Agreeable, Conscientious, Open, Basic Motives, Underlying Behavior, Personality and Self-Control, When Personalities Become Toxic, Beliefs About the World and Other People, and Beliefs About Yourself. This is a perfect course to start out with if you're enjoying the interview today with Will Storr. And here is the thing that I think that you will enjoy the most. I've arranged for a special limited time offer just for you, a free month of unlimited access to enjoy this and any of their other lectures. But to get this offer, you must sign up through my special URL. Start your free month today. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. You can listen to the entire course. You can listen to Why You Are Who You Are, Investigations into Human Personality, and you can start drawing on the research in psychology, neuroscience, and genetics, and take this course for free with your first free month, which will look at the differences in people's personalities, where those differences come from, and how they shape our everyday lives, helping us become better people who understand ourselves and those around us. So remember, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. And now we return to our program. I'm David McRaney, and this is the You Are Not So Smart podcast. We're going to pick right up where we left off with Will Storr.
Roll into, and I'm going deeper into the book to begin with here, is you talk about the authentic self. Mm. And that phrase is very popular in the current moment. And I've heard it said just this week, I've heard people use it in different contexts. And I know in working on my last project, that was a big deal for people who had felt that they had had an epiphany or they had changed in some major way. They said, you know, I feel like I am now my authentic self. So, yeah, what do you think about that?
So there's two ways of looking at it. I mean, as I'm sure you know, if you sort of talk to a lot of academics, they say that there is no such thing as an authentic self. You know, the brain is kind of modular, and we change throughout our lifetimes. We change going from situation to situation to situation. Consciousness is just sort of one experience following another, one thought following another, one impulse following another. So and this idea of the authentic self, it really becomes popular back in the US, especially around California. It's part of the human potential movement, and there's this big idea that comes up. And it really is a revolution in our view of ourselves. Because for generations, the kind of basic view that people had about what a human is that we are bad. Humans are bad. Mm. So if you're a Christian, you have original sin. Then Freud comes along, and he's supposed to be this big revolutionary, but he agrees that it's not original sin. It's, you know, we have the Oedipus complex, have all these like weird, repulsive sexual urges that need to be repressed. So, but then what happens is America comes along in all its kind of optimism and positivity and says, no, humans are amazing. And this is the kind of the controlling idea really of the human potential movement. Most famously, this guy, Carl Rogers, who had this idea or promoted this idea and that actually humans were fantastic, and the reason that humans became unhappy is because all the stuff that society and culture kind of piles on top of you, and in order to become happy and thriving and successful, we had to get rid of all that stuff and dig down to this perfect authentic self. So then you had the explosion of the sort of encounter groups and these kind of therapeutic techniques where people would just be honest with each other and dig through to their honest, authentic self, and they would stop being polite and stop being mannered and start being truthful and real. Mm-hmm. And the idea, of course, was that underneath is that they would find this kind of perfect core. And that's where the idea of the authentic self goes wrong, because there is no kind of perfect authentic core. There is no perfect version of you that's kind of buried underneath all this stuff that society and culture piles on top of you. And actually that's what started happening. I mean, it's the Esalen Institute in Big Sur in California that's most famous for kind of generating these ideas and exploring these ideas. Mm-hmm. And they would have these crazy encounter sessions where people would just be completely honest with each other. And people just started committing suicide, marriages were ending, people were violently attacked in these things. It didn't end up well. So, but we're still living very much in these human kind of human potential era, people still believe that people are amazing and special. And yeah. actually what we should be is being authentic and real with each other. But actually, you know, one of the big problems with that is that we're a social creature. Human beings are a social, a highly hypersocial animal. And we have developed behaviors like manners for a reason, and that's because we have to get on with each other. And sometimes getting on with each other and progressing in life means a certain level of kind of controlled dishonesty, you know, you might say, not being authentic in inverted commas, but actually being polite and kind to people. so it's kind of wrong-headed, this idea that there's this kind of perfect authentic self. But there is some truth to it, and that truth to it is, it really goes to the to the kind of the big five, the research that looks at personality. And so it is true, actually, that everybody has a personality type. So how we behave and then partly down to what's happening in that given moment, who the people that are kind of with us, whether we're trying to impress people or, you know, what we're trying to get, but also it's kind of in our kind of personality. So, you know, everybody has these, lies somewhere on a spectrum of kind of various personality traits. You know, obviously, I think most people know the big five, which is openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. Those are the kind of big five traits, and we all lie somewhere higher and lower on all those traits. So we're all more or less extrovert, more or less agreeable, and those big five traits, they change relatively predictably as we go throughout our lives. They don't change that much. So kind of stability is the rule. They're not completely stable, but stability is the rule. And people don't, this idea that we kind of can transform who we are, that is a big part of the human potential movement, that we can have these radical transformations, and we can turn introvert into extrovert, or, you know, we can become whoever we want to be, is actually a myth. We can't do that. You know, we're quite rooted.
Personality-wise. Because I mean, you know, because you mentioned like getting confused between personality and character, and how there was a trade-off at some point in like the whenever we were going through the suburbia days, where like people would be defined by their character, and then suddenly it was important to have a personality or a persona that you put forth. And I'm wondering, like, because I was wondering about that, reading that part about the personality traits, and you talked about this metaphor of being in there like a prison cell, and you can move around within it, but you can't go beyond the walls. It's like that's where you are when that's how your knobs are set whenever you're born, and your personality profile. And I'm wondering about that, because I've thought a lot about change here recently, and I'm wondering, like, you know, how deterministic are these personality traits for, like, behavior and, you know, life success and happiness and all these other things we think about beyond, you know, that we believe that we affect with ourselves as we move through our lives?
Well, you know, as you know, genes aren't completely deterministic. I mean, you know, so roughly kind of 50%, roughly half of what our personality is genetic. But then most of the rest of that is, all of the rest of that happens as we go through our lives. But unfortunately, most of the rest of the work of forming our personalities happens when we're young, and it's the result of kind of experiences over which we have little or no control. So once we're in our kind of mid-20s, we kind of are who we are, and of course we can change we can change marginally, but this idea that we can completely transform our personality by sheer force of will, or by, you know, going to encounter groups, or, you know, feeling the fear and doing it anywhere, or any of these other things that culture keeps telling us is possible, it is just fantasy. I mean, there are lots of kind of people that part of the problem with this is that people really, really don't want that to be true. So you always get people very skeptical of this idea that human personality is relatively stable, because it's just feels like such a depressing story. But But unfortunately, it is. You know, you can change a little bit, but you can't transform. And yeah, partly just because of so much of it is rooted in our genetics. Mm-hmm. You know, like our serotonin system, for example, is there at birth. It's set at birth, and that has a hugely powerful effect over how we kind of experience our everyday lives and ourselves within it.
Yeah, and there are other aspects of this too. I just like starting here with the authentic self, because I think we've had Bruce Hood on the show before, and you spoke to Bruce Hood and there's a couple of ideas in there. One, the looking glass self is something that is it's one of those things that in psychology that you haven't thought about it very much, but the second you see it explained, you're like, ah, yes, I know exactly what's happening. So tell everyone a little bit about how that adds to this this sort of conundrum of the self, this other aspect that is makes the authentic self seem less and less tangible.
Yeah, so the idea of the looking glass self is the answer to the question, how do we work out what we're like? How do we work out who we are and what we're like? You know, we're sort of looking out of our eyes and hearing out of our ears. So how do we work out, you know, who we are? And the answer is we are who we think other people think we are. So we look out into our social worlds, and we're constantly looking at the reactions we're getting to the things we're saying and how we're behaving, the listening to the things people are saying about us. And that kind of builds our sense of who we are and what we're like. So yeah, they call it the looking glass self. So again, it's another way that we are, this idea of the authentic self is a bit of a myth, because it's to a great extent constructed by other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can all experience this as we move through job to home to friends to the bar to, you know, there's I forget the psychologist who said it, but there's as many selves as we have social groups to which we, you know, we are.
Exactly. People talk about the Facebook self and the Twitter self and the Instagram self all being different.
Yeah.
And you're a certain you when you're with your parents, certain you when you're with your partner. I'm definitely a different version of me on Monday than I'm on Friday. There's a morning me and an evening me.
Yeah.
And it's really, I don't write about this and stuff, but it's always, you know, look, as most middle-aged men do, I struggle with dad bod, you know, quite a lot. And so I go through phases of just, right, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to eat sensibly. And then it comes to Friday at kind of 4:30 p.m. and I'm just eating chocolate, you know. And it's like, you know, that's the struggle that so many people have, millions of people have. And it's hard to work it out because, you know, at one point I'm completely determined. I'm going to lose weight. I don't want dad bod. You know, I'm going to eat sensibly. I'm in my 40s. I'm not a child anymore. I don't need chocolate, for God's sake. And then literally 2-3 days later, when I observe myself doing that now, having learned about the kind of the malleability of who we are, I realize that there's actually two different versions of me. It's two different personalities in a way, with two different sets of values. And the set of values that the Monday morning one has is I value, you know, the way I look, and I value health, and I value not prematurely aging over these childish cravings for sugar and chocolate. And the values of the Friday afternoon, you're like, ah, sod it, God, you only live once, you know, it's just a bit of chocolate. It's a completely different self, is how it feels. So it's interesting. So although that core, that personality core, is still there, in the sense that I am still the personality that I am, I still have those traits, you move around that core, and it kind of expresses in very different ways, and to almost to such a degree that you almost feel like you become a different person at different points in the week, and that affects, you know, your behavior. Yeah. And that's how you end up chastising yourself and going, I can't believe you did that. you know, we all have that experience of saying that and feeling that.
Oh, yeah. I apologize. I was drinking. I wasn't myself.
Yeah. You know, I haven't drunk for 20 years and I still do that. And that only makes sense if you realize that actually, yeah, you are different versions of yourself. And one, and in that moment, one version of you is apologizing for another version of you. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of creepy when you think about it. But I think that explains why people find it so hard to give up drinking and to give up smoking and to give up binge eating, is because there's different yous doing those behavior, and one you has only loose control over the other you.
And I was excited that you mentioned this in the book, because it's something David Eagleman had said in passing, or maybe it was said in a book, but you bring it up and you dive really deep into it in your new book, you know, that we are, and this is sort of what we're talking about. We have these personality traits that seem pretty stable throughout our lives, but the organism is the mental organism is more like a bickering parliament of competing agencies, and they all want different things. And so they are arranged differently, and they win and lose, and it never ends. And so this feeling that there's an authentic self, that's this one thing, the research bears out that it's more like a bickering parliament of competing agencies.
Yes. So it's like a democracy. You've got all these kind of different kind of circuits and networks all competing to, you know, be your behavior. So you're constantly have these different parts of you arguing about what you should do next, and the winner of those arguments becomes your behavior. So again, that's another kind of huge strike against is this idea that we've got this kind of authentic self. And kind of in a layer over the top of that, of course, is personality, and your kind of personality, I guess, is going to kind of control to a certain extent how likely certain one behavior is going to be to win over another. Yeah. So my personality, so I'm high in trait neuroticism, which is a really bad thing. That's the one thing you don't want to be. It's not good. So it means that I am much more sensitive to signals of danger in my environment. That's just how I'm wired up, whether it's, you know, something in my neurochemistry or the size of my amygdala or whatever. It just so happens that I am high in trait neuroticism. So that has lots of bad effects. It means that I get paranoid. You know, I get little kind of persecution complex, and I can be very defensive with people. Mm. But it's also a good thing, because I'm constantly worrying and thinking, and that's, I wouldn't be a writer if I wasn't constantly worrying and thinking, because those worries about how the world's working and that neurosis and that need to control the world has kind of formed my career in a sense, because it becomes the books. Neurotic need to understand how people work, and then so you become interested in psychology. So you do have this. It's not an authentic self as it is much as a kind of a mood. One way I think about it is that everybody has an implicit theory of control. The brain has its own general theory of how it should control the world. If you think of your brain's ultimate mission as it needs to control the world, that's its number one job, is to control the world to help enable you to get what you want out of it. And so we all have this implicit theory of control, and a big part of that is personality. So if you're high in neuroticism, your theory of control is, well, I need to be hyper alert for signals of danger. And when I see signals of potential threat or danger, I need to strike and act and do something about it. And that's completely different to somebody kind of low in neuroticism, who'd be much more laid back and happy and allow things to happen. It's interesting, I think, when you see it through the lens of control, which I think is what kind of all brains ultimately want to do.
Yeah. And, I mean, but, you know, you talk about your neuroticism, but you've also, and you're always looking for danger, but you've also chosen a profession, or, you know, maybe you didn't. Maybe this is what we're talking about. Maybe you didn't choose it. It was culture and personality traits and everything else. But you're in a profession where you put yourself in extreme danger many times. How does that sort out for you?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's what makes no sense. Because, yeah, so it ends up with you worrying a lot and being scared a lot. But then sort of the worrying and being scared makes good copy on the page. You know, it makes for good story. So yeah, there's often times been in my career when I've put myself in dangerous situations. But it's if I hadn't have been scared and worried in those situations, then it would have been sort of fairly boring to read about. And what was interesting was when I interviewed Professor Daniel Nettle, who's one of the big psychology guys, was he before I told him what my personality type was, he said most writers are high in neuroticism and also high in openness, which is openness to experience. They want to go out and experience the world. They're interested in different ideas, and that's exactly what I am. So that was the moment when I, you know, when you suddenly sort of I believe this. I really believe what this guy's telling me now, because he absolutely kind of nailed me. So yeah, there's a tension there between the neuroticism and the openness, but yeah. I think that's probably true of lots of writers.
Well, yeah, so you have dramatic tension just built into your
built-in.
Yeah. You just express it, and that's how you do your thing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I feel better about myself too now. Thank you. I really love this study. It was by Mark Snyder. And if you remember it, I'd love to hear you talk about it. But if not, we can just kind of talk about it back and forth. But it's the men thought they were talking to beautiful women. And the people, not only did they change the way that they...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the people on the other end did too, which sort of illustrated the point. If you could go through that...
Yeah, so this was a really great study by, as you say, by Professor Mark Snyder, and they got 51 guys, and they got them to speak to each one of them to speak to a woman via this intercom system, and before they had the conversation, they were given a Polaroid and said, "This is the woman you're going to be speaking to." Now, obviously, you know how these studies work. The Polaroid was nonsense. The test was you know, would the image on the Polaroid affect their impression of the conversation with the woman. And so when they analyzed the conversations, they found that if they had a Polaroid of a really attractive woman, they found them much more kind of kind, likable, sociable. So it really altered their impression of who they were talking about. And this goes back to this one of these sort of ancient Greek ideas, which is still very dominant in our individualist society, which is that beautiful people are good people. Are beautiful, that you can judge someone's moral worth and personality on their kind of the state of their kind of physical body. But the really interesting thing about that was that. The women on the other end of the phone actually started acting in that way. So the kind of false belief that the men kind of generated by looking at the Polaroid became real in the behavior of the women. And again, this is just another sort of knocking the idea of this, there is this authentic self.
Yeah.
Because we are constantly changing and altering our behavior and how we're acting as the situation changes, as the environment that we're in is changing and altering, so we're becoming kind of different versions of us.
It was just the feedback loop was so crazy to me, because these men are exhibiting different behavior because of what they've been told about their environment, and then the women are changing their behavior to match the behavior of the men because they're seeing themselves through their eyes, and then now the men are seeing themselves through the eyes of a woman who is different, and just now we're building up to this. This sort of syncing up on a lie. It starts with a lie, but the lie becomes the truth.
It is, and I think that's just a glimpse of how just the extraordinary degree to which people can be experiencing completely different versions of the same world. You know, you could be sitting next to somebody, and their personality. If you think about it, so. You know, they find that extroverts genuinely do get, you know, extroverts, because they love company and they value other people and they value kind of experience and the value kind of experiences. They will get invited to more parties than the non-extroverts. And then when they're at those parties, they'll get on with people much better. So your personality kind of creates, and your behavior creates a whole different world for you to exist in. You know, you've remembered we're hyper social animals, and the world in which we live is a world of people, you know, like, so all animals are specialized for their particular environment. You know, dogs live in a world of smell, and that world of other people completely changes depending on how we are behaving and interacting with that world, and then how that world responds to us, as you say, then changes how we're behaving and interacting, and it creates this kind of massive feedback loop.
Yeah.
And I think we, you know, I think we really massively underestimate difference. One of the kind of well-known biases is that we assume that other minds are exactly like ours. You know, we're constantly saying, well, I wouldn't have behaved like that, so why should they behave like that? And we really imagine that we have these powers of empathy, but I think it's almost impossible to truly empathize with somebody. It's almost impossible to put yourself fully into somebody else's shoes, because people are so different from each other, and they have such different experiences of, you know, life, the universe, and everything than other people do. And it's so hard to get even a sense of what it truly is to be someone else.
You know, that feedback loop can go in the other direction, as you mentioned, which was, you say that in the book, that if people who think that they're talking to someone who isn't attractive, or they think that they are lonely, they treat them that way, and then that person becomes lonely, and they see themselves that way, and then you have that feedback loop, which goes in the other direction. Yeah. This leads me to a question, and this is just speculation. This is just what you think. I think about, if you become aware of your personality type and you know that you are an introvert, and that's creating more and more introverted situations, does that open up the opportunity to actively choose to behave as if you weren't the person that you really are personality wise, and then get a different result out of life? If you say, fuck being authentic, I am a complicated, I contain multitudes, and you know, there's a parliament in my mind, my personality is genetic, I have primal urges that I cannot control, I must eat and I want to mate and have shelter, and then there's the looking glass self, and then there's also every psychology book ever written. That's what I'm asking. Like, doesn't that give you some ability to now actually escape the prison of this authentic self thing?
So you can change your world without changing yourself. So one of the things I talk about at the very end of the book is this idea of the lizard and the iceberg, right? So if you imagine a lizard on an iceberg, it's a really miserable lizard. It's a really unhappy lizard. But you take that same lizard and you put it in the desert, the lizard's delighted. It's the happiest lizard you've ever seen. So that lizard's world, you know, happiness levels has completely changed, but nothing in that lizard has changed. Mm. So, you know, so we live in a society, in a culture, that tells us that we can change and we can be whoever we want to be, and it tells us that we have that power. You can do whatever you want to do, be whoever you want to be, and that's rubbish. You cannot be whoever you want to be. You cannot be Beyonce. You cannot be Michael Jordan. So I think the emphasis is wrong. The emphasis shouldn't be in you should change. The emphasis should be on you should change kind of the environment around you. And one crucial way of doing that, as you say, is actually understanding who you are. So you know, I think people should do that personality test. And since I did that personality test, when I first found out I was high in neuroticism and that this was a fairly stable personality trait, and there was nothing I could do about it, of course I was a bit depressed about that. it's not a nice thing to find out, but it ends up becoming really liberating, because the first thing that's liberating is that I spent years thinking there was something wrong with me, because I didn't particularly like parties and company. I didn't particularly have many friends, or kind of value that kind of those relationships. And I'd watch television and think, well, I'm broken. There's something wrong with me. And I'd always feel guilty and kind of almost like disturbed by the whole thing. It's like, what's wrong with me? And then you realize there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just a certain kind of person.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's really a nice feeling. You think, God, thank God I'm not broken. I'm just a certain kind of person. But the other thing it's done is, because I found out that I'm a bit neurotic, and I found out I'm also low in agreeableness. So that's not a nice combination, because it means I can, you know, sometimes I can completely without realizing it, I can just offend people, and I don't really know I've done it. And having a wife is really useful for that. A wife who can say, you know, that you didn't deal with that very well, and actually that bad thing just happened. That was really your fault. And I go, oh, is it? But understanding that, and understanding kind of how being able to kind of observe yourself in that way and observe, yeah, I'm being disagreeable here, I'm being neurotic here. You're right. You can never stop yourself doing those things completely because that's who you are. But you can have that level of knowingness where you can start trying to mitigate for those things. You know, you can walk into a difficult situation socially where there's lots of people who you don't know and that's uncomfortable, knowing, okay, this is going to push all the wrong buttons, so you're going to have to put your game face on. And so psychologists call this idea of free traits. As limited as we are free to adopt traits we don't have. We can act as if we are extroverted, so we can choose to do that. And having that knowledge, then of course then you're in a positive feedback loop where people are saying, "Oh, this person's actually really nice," and so you can, you can create a better social world for yourself to exist in. But the first step is that is knowing that you are a certain kind of personality and knowing what those traits are and knowing then what your potential weaknesses and problems are going to be.
Yeah.
And I think the difference is because it feels like, you know, I'm talking about self, accepting yourself for who you are, accepting yourself with all your limitations and all your problems. But that very easily slips into that kind of space where you're saying, well, that's just me, deal with it, tough. If you can't deal with me, then you don't deserve me, you know, all that stuff, which is where it goes wrong. And my perspective is just understanding that you're limited in particular, and that sometimes you're going to have to mitigate for that when you don't want to. And other times, inevitably, you're going to get it wrong again and again and again. And don't beat yourself up for that, because that's who you are. But at the same time, do say sorry and do have a bit of humility and do have the kind of space within yourself to kind of reach out and say, "Ah, oh, I created that bad situation. I'm sorry about that." You know, it's not just, you know, like I'm talking about neurotics, but you know, our culture massively values extroverts. Extroversion is a really kind of is a personality trait that our kind of very individualistic, atomized culture really values. But you know, it's no picnic necessarily being an extrovert either. Extroverts can be really annoying. You know, they can never stop talking. They're risk takers. They're much more likely to have affairs and have casual sex, and they're much more likely to die early because they've done something stupid. So every personality type comes with it a series of benefits, but also a series of potential problems. And I just think it's really useful to know what your personality is, because then you can start having a rational take on, okay, this is me. What are the things I'm likely to do wrong, and how can I mitigate, and when do I need to say sorry and understand that I've created this situation simply by being me?
I'm telling you, Will, this is a tremendous to me because this concept of changing yourself, improving yourself to your own, you know, self, be true. There's so many different ways to look at it, and the prescription I've received for most of my life, even from academia, has been because when I was in school, I was at first the first thing I did before I became a journalist was I was training to be a Rogerian therapist.
Wow.
I was already in the higher level classes where we were doing therapy back and forth, you know? And that's like where when I really got the bug for, talking about psychology. And, so this notion, and this is something that's just prescriptive advice from Western and American and Southern, since I'm from the South, and also Rogerian, I have all these things hitting me at the same time saying, like, how do you manifest the life you want to have or whatever? And it's always about figure out, you know, who, change yourself, but become this better version of you, the best version of you, and all these things. Really work, take a socket wrench to your insides and, you know, fix stuff and figure out what's broken and repair it.
And I think what's interesting to me is that whenever people become kind of utopian in their ideas, whether it's creating the perfect world or creating the perfect person, they always go to blank slate. Whether you're left wing or right wing, I don't care. You always end up, when you go too far, you always end up in a blank slate place. And because it's so alluring and it's so seductive that we can create kind of perfect people and perfect worlds. And you know, genes are real. It's a real thing.
It's true.
You know, you're very tall
people.
And the stuff that isn't genetic, as I say, is most of the rest of the work that gets done on who you are happens in the early part of your life, and it's kind of events and situations over which you have no control. So you can't take it, as you say, take a socket wrench to yourself. It's really about, and I think the emphasis should be about on, especially because, you know, we're living in this neoliberal, highly individualistic kind of westernized kind of culture, and so the goal always seems to be to become wealthy and to achieve stuff on the kind of economic level. But I think it's much wiser to be encouraging people, especially young people, to find out who you are, and then find this find that little corner of the world in which you can be sort of quite good at something. I think that's what true happiness is.
Yeah,
even if that thing isn't making you rich, it's just find that tiny, even if it's a weird thing like collecting pebbles, I don't know, whatever it is, find that little corner of the world which really attracts you and fills you with kind of joy and interest and gives you something that you can be quite good at, because we all want status, we all want to be quite good at something, and that's happiness, you know. And we can be happy not earning much money as long as we're quite good at the thing that we're doing, and it's the thing that we enjoy doing. That's the important thing, and that doesn't involve changing yourself at all. That actually involves finding out who the hell you are and then following that path. And I think the sooner that we can do that, the better. And that's why I think it's actually quite damaging telling young people that they can do whatever they want to do and be whoever they want to be. Because if you tell young people that, they all want to be Beyonce or Michael Jordan. Of course they do. And you end up with lots of very disappointed people.
But it's so empowering to say, you know, that's a charged word. I should have chosen another one. But there's but you can control, you know, you can find the others if that's what we're talking about. Or you can find the place, as you were describing, where you can be good at being yourself and use that self that you're dealing with to get something out of life. Or you can find the community or region where you're more likely to plug in. I mean, that is, front-ending knowing yourself, and then on the back end, using that to create your environment the way you would, you know, hack into the forest and build a cabin. I like this a lot. Okay. Let me back off of that. You still have some time?
You can find Selfie, How We Became So Self-Obsessed, wherever they trade money for books. And Will's next book is called The Science of Storytelling, and you can find him at willstorr.com. That's S-T-O-R-R. And you can find him on Twitter. He tweets at W-S-T-O-R-R. That is it for this episode of the You're Not So Smart podcast. You can find links to everything that we talked about in this episode at youarenotsosmart.com. You can find show notes there. You can also find previous episodes there and at iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. You can find You're Not So Smart at NotSmartBlog on Twitter, and I am at David McCraney. Also, you can just find all the stuff that happens with You Are Not So Smart at the You Are Not So Smart Facebook page. It's just / You Are Not So Smart. And if you would like to contribute to this project, this is a one-person operation, you can go to Patreon, patreon.com/ You Are Not So Smart. Pitching in at any amount will get you the show ad-free, but at the higher amounts, you can get things like shirts and books that are signed and all sorts of other stuff. Just check it out at patreon.com/ You Are Not So Smart. Lots of really cool shows coming up in the future. There's going to be a show about the elaboration likelihood model. That's a persuasion technique. There's going to be a show with Dean Burnett and his new book about the happy brain, how all the psychology stuff that we now know about happiness that replaces the old stuff that we used to know. And I promise we have new logical fallacy episodes coming up. I'm actually doing the crucial last interview this week. Okay. See you soon.